Well, good morning, everyone. As always, we would like to start our meeting with a safety contact. I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Doherty.
Thank you, Chairman Acosta and members of the committee. First, I'd like to mention the, in the event the emergency or fire alarm goes off, exiting of the building, either through the main doors that came in, out the front door, or behind you at the exit, and we would assemble in front of the National Building Museum by the nut and bolt sculpture so that we could account for everyone. This month's safety contact, since we are now in the holiday season, and this means trees, lights, and other decorations going up around our homes, the National Fire Protection Association offers some tips for a happy and safe holiday season. The NFPA recommends that for trees that you select a fresh tree, look for green needles that don't fall off when you touch or shake the branch. And for artificial trees, look for the label that says that they're fire retardant. For fresh trees, it's recommended that you cut an inch or two off the bottom of the trunk, and this will allow the tree to absorb water and remain fresher longer. Place trees away from radiators, fireplaces, wood stoves, and other heat sources. Keep trees well watered, and this means watering every day. Buy tree lights that have been approved by a testing laboratory such as UL United Laboratories. There should be a label that actually indicates that on the string or on the box. For outdoor trees, use only lights certified for outdoor use. Never use indoor lights outside. Read the manufacturer's instructions about how many strands of lights you can connect together. Typically, it's no more than five. Turn off Christmas tree lights when going to bed or leaving the house. And when the holiday is over, please get rid of the live trees because they will die and then they will create a fire hazard. For candles, the NFPA recommends that you don't light holiday candles if you have pets or young children in the house. Lighted candles can easily be knocked over and start a fire. You may choose flameless candles instead for the festive look and the scent. Never leave candles burning when you leave a room. Keep candles a good foot away from anything that can burn, such as curtains or paper. If you light candles, make sure they're in a holder wide enough and heavy enough to help prevent lighted candles from tipping over. Be careful when lighting candles to make sure that your clothing and hair is not going to catch fire. And replace candles before they burn all the way down. Mr. Chairman, this would conclude the safety contact for this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Doherty. Before the committee is an agenda, I have just a few notes about today's agenda. We're going to be hearing two informational presentations. The first one is a presentation by Assistant General Manager Bob Troop, and he'll update us on this year's capital program and provide us a look at our progress in the first quarter, including rebuilding work that has been accomplished against budget milestones. The second agenda item will include a presentation by Bill Green. He will update us on the continued work on the staff's part to prepare the FY14 budget, and the general manager's budget will be presented to us at our next committee meeting. He's going to show us an overview of the additional business plan initiatives that are being proposed for FY2014 in support of our recently endorsed strategic goals. Also, as part of this discussion, he's going to touch upon the Silver Line changes. And as many of you know, this will also be discussed in great detail in our customer service and operations meeting this afternoon, chaired by Mr. Downs. So today, at least this morning, we'll be talking about the budget impacts of that. This afternoon, there'll be a fairly robust discussion about the actual service changes and the implications of that on our customers and to our service as part of the customer service discussion. So with that, I'd like just to move forward with the agenda as presented. Next up are the approval of the minutes. I would entertain a motion to approve the November 1st minutes. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Minutes pass. Next up, we'll hear the presentation on the quarterly capital progress update. Mr. Troop.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm very pleased to present the first quarter report for the fiscal year 2013 capital budget. Because of the program initiatives we have undertaken in managing the capital program, we are looking at the 2013 investments to be significant in terms of improvements to the right-of-way and also creating operational efficiencies. MOD is an important part of the region, and we are always thankful for the support given to us by the jurisdictions and also the federal government. Our investments to date for the capital program for the first quarter were $119 million, which is just on the north side of 12% of the forecasted annual amount of $975 million. Many initiatives are under contract, which will accelerate the investment rate. Items such as the test track and commissioning facility, NC Drive Strategic Operations Command Center, and the human capital management technology investments. In addition, available track time and advanced planning of revenue service adjustments has allowed us to achieve good performance of initiatives on the line contracts. Also, we recently approved the PAL breaker as a variance for the red line contract, and this will accelerate substation state of good repair. Our efforts to reduce backlog and achieve steady state for track infrastructure are continuing at the projected pace for fiscal year 2013. Some major initiatives for IT have gotten some ground under the wheels also, and human capital management and contract lifecycle management enterprise solutions will enable better efficiencies within those specific areas. Again, diversity of projects. In order to provide safe and reliable transit service for this region, it is essential that we reinvest in the entirety of the system. Bus, rail, metro access, and support systems must all benefit from the capital program to provide a better and more efficient metro system. Safety, reliability, and efficiency are our goals for the capital program. We achieve that by establishing specific targets for reductions of backlog, steady state requirements, repair of deficient items, new initiative projects, and expansion. We ensure comprehensive investment by dividing the projects into definable service elements and can readily ascertain both the amount and percentage of capital investment. This gives transparency into the gross elements of the spending apportionment. All of the various categories on this chart provide equitable and prioritized spending for the various transportation modes and support departments. Investment in capital state of good repair is not a once-and-done item. I have spoken about how our system requires program steady state investment in order to retain a steady state and a state of good repair once this backlog has been eliminated. Because our track welding program illustrates why state of good repair is an ongoing measure or steady state, I want to take some time to discuss the particulars of this initiative. Welds are required where we have joint bars connecting two pieces of rail together, and the joint bar is on the left side of the slide there. And here's a joint bar, and you can see it provides a bolted connection between two pieces of a running rail. Years ago, which is actually when I started my career, the rail was predominantly bolted in 39-foot sections. In fact, my first job was to roll these rails off the right-of-way to allow for installation of continuous welded rail, or CWR. And this was an advancement in rail technology that had wide-scale application in the United States beginning in the 1970s. The reason welded rail was adopted is because the mechanics of a joint bar necessitate greater inspection, more impact to infrastructure, requires installation of additional material for return current mitigation, and it also decreases passenger comfort. It's interesting to note that old railroad bridge designs had to take into account jointed rail impact loading as a result of the weight of locomotives that would drop on the joints and increase the resultant load on the structure. This is why when you see those old railroad bridges, there's a lot of riveted steel out there. Advancements in CWR technology allow for less impact loads and therefore decreased maintenance along the right-of-way. The rail-headed joints also wears at a greater rate and has higher levels of chipping and cracking. Obviously, removing these joints through our flash butt welding contract is essential to maintaining greater safety and reliability. The flash butt welder actually pulls the gap of the rail in place. It literally stretches the rail with 120,000 pounds of foot torque and welds the ends together, making a seamless run of CWR. Currently, our backlog for these joints is about 4,000, and we incur about 500 per year. I think the question would be, why do these 500 new joints appear on the system? Well, rail wears. Rail needs to be replaced. We replace on average 21 miles of rail each year. Our CWR sections are approximately 390 feet in length, which again is a manageable length for us to install within our work window constraints. In addition, we put in plugs to remove rail that is having site-specific wear and does not need the 390 feet replaced. And here's why we replace rail. This is a new piece of rail. You can see, you know, the base is not corroded. The head of the rail is fine. This is an old piece of rail, and you can see how we have base rail corrosion through here, corrosion on the web, on the head, and on the web as well. This was taken out of medical center. Now, why do we have base rail corrosion? Well, water migrates through holes in the tunnel lining, And Stray Current is exasperated by this water, deteriorating return cables, bad insulator, and high resultant resistant third rail. So what we have is projects that include rail replacement, return cable replacement, leak mitigation, third rail installation, insulator replacement, and rail welding programs. Most everything along the right-of-way, in fact, most everything we do has a cause and effect nature. So it's essential to take care of these issues, not just one. Next slide, please.
Could I ask a quick question?
Yes.
On the deteriorated rail,
mm-hmm.
how long does it take to get to this condition, and what is an average estimate?
In medical center, that's actually about 18 months to 2 years to be able to get into that condition. Again, because
2 years to this condition?
To that condition, yeah.
Okay.
And that's, again, because of the water mitigation issues that we have, the type of water that's
the is this typical, or is that a
unique? It is not typical.
Yeah.
That is not typical. I mean, base rail corrosion is in the issues where we have mostly water intrusion, like I said, in the deep port tunnels, like through Medical Center, Bethesda, those areas.
And we've identified those areas where it's highly
oh, absolutely. And we have greater levels of inspection through those. We have greater levels of inspection. We also have mitigating effects to take into account there. So, I want to talk a little bit about productivity. As we work to maximize our productivity, we analyze those factors which influence our investments and determine where we may reduce our cost per unit. For a cross-tie installation, we know that we have an average cost of approximately $550 per installed tie. Our material costs account for about 25% of that, and the challenge is to find methods to reduce the installed cost. This is why calculation and production ratios are so important, and the early out and weekend outages are so vital to our investments in the capital program. As indicated, within a five-hour work window, we actually achieve a 50% production time. This is because in order to work safely, the third power needs to be de-energized, it needs to be protected against re-energization, and verified with protected devices. Additionally, work equipment needs to traverse the right-of-way to get to the location. This chart illustrates typical times in the form of mobilization and demobilization, which are indicated in red. These same activities need to occur regardless of the available work window. By establishing longer work windows, we can reduce the ratio there and therefore increase our productive times. As can be seen, we achieve near manufacturing floor production when we move to weekend outages. We recognize the service disruptions, but these continue to be necessary in order to maintain our steady state and state of good repair requirements. This type of analysis was done when we initially had daylight non-peak work, and what we realized was the production window and subsequent production did not adequately justify the service disruption, and therefore no longer utilized that window for installation activities. As I continue to say, one of the most important investments is in achieving a steady state. Our goals are well-defined, but it does continue to require service disruptions, which are a necessary part to ensure the future viability of the railroad. As with the last quarter, the presentation is arranged by the same common headers, which are found in your 2013 Q1 report materials. Again, for the purpose of this presentation, I've only included specific items which may be of concern as it relates to steady state maintenance, passenger focus, safety items, and large-scale reportable items. Since we're in the first quarter of the fiscal year, you can see the progress is just beginning on most of these items. Maintaining the right-of-way infrastructure continues to be a high priority as we reduce backlog and work to achieve steady-state maintenance cycles. And what's interesting here to note, and what I want to point out, is that nearly all of this work is being performed by WMATA Force Account with WMATA-owned equipment. Escalator and elevator rehabilitation is progressing within schedule. The replacement work will begin accelerating in 2014 as the designs are approved and fabrication moves into production. The replacement rehabilitation of buses and metro access vehicles remains on target for fiscal year 2013 with delivery of all planned vehicles within the prescribed time frame and within budget. Our initiatives for the NTSB recommendations continue to move at the projected pace with replacement of the Generation 2 track circuits being the most critical. The numbers indicated, while seemingly low, are actually good, as the first quarter was designated for manufacturing of materials and the remaining quarters for the installation. Cinderbed Bus Garage is still under litigation, with the Virginia Supreme Court agreeing to hear the plaintiff's case. This will not be heard until at the very earliest mid-March, with decision not to come until our fiscal year 2014. Projections for this project had it moving forward this year, so we continue to lag behind projected investment due to pending court hearings. However, Test Track, the Strategic Operations Command Center, and the police substation are well within the current projections. Track time and revenue service adjustments will continue to be utilized as we have a significant number of wayside-related initiatives. We have numerous projects that, while helping to increase safety, security, and efficiency, are not part of our regular maintenance cycles. These include the neutral host project, NTSB track circuit replacement, and wayside warning systems. Obviously, these are important pieces to ensuring safety and security and have high importance and priority. Our desire to manage these revenue service adjustments is to ensure that we are maximizing the return on this investment. The more efficient our process is, the more value we get for our capital dollar. This is the challenge with the equitable priority. And when I talk about equitable priority, I'm talking about things like neutral host, track circuit replacement, rail replacement, fastener replacement, all these things which need to occur on the right of way that have equitability and priority in getting these done. And our decision is not to defer these, but to move forward with long-range planning that addresses these issues in a manner that ensures a safe and reliable system that our passengers feel is operated in a secure environment. Management of the capital dollars needs to look at not just the assets in which we are investing, but also those assets that are in relation to the vision of the system and what those assets accomplish with this investment. State of good repair is essential, but a balanced approach towards growth is also critical as we continue to support the region. We owe a lot to the early planners and constructors who, in a modest infancy, carried the vision forward, that built this system through many different economic and political climates. That was their foundation of success, and is now ours to ensure the momentum continues. Thank you, and at this time, I'll ask you if there are any questions or need for clarifications.
Thank you, Mr. Troop. Are there any questions? Mr. Bolger, Mr. Downey, and then Mr. Dyke.
Let's turn to the escalator rehabilitation. What's the story on DuPont Circle? I'm being asked and asked. It's out. It's brand new, and it's out of service, and then it's broken again. Is that covered in here, or are we under warranty?
We're under warranty. We're under warranty on these specific items. We do know that we had a motor burn up on DuPont Circle. We've also had some trips, again, because of the way the safety devices for the cone plates, you know, because there's a higher level of safety device in these. We've had some trips on the cone plate devices on these. We have the manufacturing looking in. We've gotten the replacement parts, and we're also looking to make sure that we're not going to have these issues going down the road. So they're doing more than that just to make sure that it's done.
Mr. Downey?
The progress report is excellent in terms of the actual delivery. Could I also ask how we are doing at the front end in terms of contracts and approvals and being sure that you get the work to you so it can get done?
Certainly. For the contracts and the approvals for getting basically NTPs on those contracts, is that what you're making reference to? Or?
Going through the procurement process, the planning process, the procurement process, everything that leads to a funded project.
Yeah, I think what we're doing
is
we're actually
going on schedule.
It is going well. Mm-hmm. I will say we obviously have challenges. I think there's a, you know, excuse me, there's sort of meet in the middle with, you know, expectations from engineering and the people that are building it to the procurement people who actually have these things to do. So, you know, what we've done is we've really sat down from an engineering perspective and construction perspective to say, what's the true time frame that it takes to be able to get a procurement in place? And I think we've been able to rationalize those, and also we've done analysis to say, where can we improve that process, particularly on the front end? Because, like, you know, what I'm fond of saying is, you know, all that stuff on the left side just squeezes the construction. You know, that's all it does. It doesn't, you know, the end date doesn't change. It squeezes. We need to get that stuff done because that's the stuff that we really can control well. So we develop better specifications. You know, we work closer with procurement to make these items. We look for efficiencies into those things. So I think that we're doing well. There is still some work to do in that regard. There's no question about that. There's still some work to do in that regard. And it also is managing the type of contracts we have, design, bid, RFPs, IDIQs, really to sit down with them and say, what's the best opportunity for us to do on those?
Let me just ask the CEO also, are you paying attention to this part of moving the program?
Yes, I am.
There are a bunch of different people who report to you.
Yes. Like Rob, I was usually the guy dealing with the right end of the schedule and hated that what was going on the left end. So it's focused. There's been improvement. We've got more work to do on it. Mr. Dyke?
Yeah, I think you may have alluded to it a little bit, but I want to make sure the spend rate, the investment rate, I noticed you mentioned the $119 million, we were only at 12% in the first quarter, and on the maintenance, we're only at 5%. But you're comfortable that it'll be picking up in the last three quarters so that we will be on target? Because obviously with those figures, if it was projected year-long.
Yes, I am very comfortable. I meet with all the project managers at least once a month. The capital program people meet with them, excuse me, on a greater level to actually detail out their contracts. We have a lot of discussion in regards to, you know, their ability to spend the money and trying to head off any issues that they have early on. The 12% that you see, there's two big reasons for that. One of the first ones is because we had such huge billings in our last quarter of 2012. Excuse me. The ability for the contractors and vendors to actually bill us was diminished somewhat in that first quarter because we had asked for so much billing in the last quarter. So their ability, you know, to be able to bill us on that was somewhat diminished. In addition, some of the projects that are moving forward, like the test track commissioning facility, the Strategic Operations Command Center, those contracts were in the infancy, so now they're really started. We're out there actually doing work for test track and commissioning facility. We're beyond the mobilization and demobilization space, so we'll see a ramp up and acceleration of those contracts.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Ms. Hines?
Mr. Troop, if I could just follow up on that for a second. So that red line is last year's spend profile,
that's
right?
Correct, yes.
And we plan to spend more this year?
That's correct, yes.
So when you come back to us in 2 or 3 months and you show us the next quarter, is it likely my blue line is going to be above the red line?
My expectation is that will be the case. Okay. Every indication indicates that will be the case.
Good,
I mean, we've done a significant analysis.
I just think
analysis.
That's helpful for us to all have in our minds is that we're going to see it cross over and run above.
Yes, that's
in
correct.
In order to achieve our goal.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Downing?
Yeah, just looking to the future, at some appropriate time, I'd like to have us get a progress report on the car delivery, or how that's going.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Troop? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go to our next agenda item, which is the FY 2014 Preliminary Capital and Operating Budget Update, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're here today to talk and update you on the committee on our progress towards the development of the budget, utilizing our business plans and our process to link the allocation of resources to program delivery in the strategic plan. We'll talk today about budget development, background and assumptions, the pro forma budget, and you had asked for a couple of updates, the Silver Line schedule update and the Silver Line, staffing, and the Silver Line cost updates. As well as an update on, you had a question on the CIP, on the part of the CNI that was not included in this CIP at this time. So we are using this strategic framework to develop our budget. We were here last month. We talked to you at great length about our business plans and the success that we're having with those business plans in linking those investment actions with the strategic plan. Those business plans outline the actions and strategies that we'll use to take to help deliver those goals and bring us closer to, and also help us to bring closer the capital and operating programs as well. We're here to discuss the allocation of resources, which is the slide in the box in red, and that's what we'll be talking about today primarily. Next slide, please. You've seen this table before. In your books, you'll note that this table is blue-sheeted, and I want to draw your attention to what was blue-sheeted. When we were here in February with this table, or excuse me, in I believe it was May with this table, we had the Silver Line propulsion costs actually captured up in the line that says non-personnel costs. So we made that adjustment moving actually $2 million down in FY 14 $3 million down in 15 and so forth. The total remained the same. They were just not captured in the right category. We had all the costs in the Silver Line line except those propulsion costs. So you can see this was the basis for our discussion. Where we left you, we had about a $76 million gap, and we committed to you to come back and try to narrow that gap, and we're here today to talk to you a little bit about that. As I said, we're building our plan using the framework of the strategic plan and the four goals of the strategic plan. You can see them here. We're taking each of our initiatives. We're building on the successes we had in FY12. And in FY12, you can see for safety that we began to address the fatigue management with our automatic train control and power personnel. We increased bus security to reduce crime. We improved our rail operation safety and improved our safety communication. We're going to build on that this year, and you'll see in a moment we've got some new initiatives that we would propose. We're going to continue our focus on fatigue management. We're going to increase system safety and response time using better information from our various systems. We're going to improve rail operation safety, and we're going to build on current actions and to maintain the station and cooling facilities. Under quality service, last year, we improved the maintenance of our elevators and escalators. There was a significant investment in that. We improved our use of all media resources to improve communication with our customers, including metro alerts, real-time bus information, better signage, et cetera. And lastly, smart trip. Many smart trip enhancements have increased our customer experience, satisfaction with that experience. For example, using auto reload and using credit cards at our parking lots. We're going to build on that. We're going to implement customer training for our bus operators and frontline employees is one initiative you'll see shortly. Financial stability, as committed in FY12, we're increasing our maintenance capacity. That is our capability to deliver the necessary maintenance to rebuild and maintain the system. We've increased escalator facility maintenance, track and structure, and rail car maintenance. The maintenance organizations, I think I briefed you on this last month, they all include actions in those business plans that outline how they're going to meet that commitment and use new innovative techniques to do that. As I say, we're going to build on that in FY14. We've got two very innovative initiatives. One is employee wellness. It's an initiative to take a proactive approach to controlling health care costs. We believe there's a lot of potential in this. We're planting the seeds of that we begin it actually this year, and we'll plant the seeds of that next year. And I'll talk about that more in a moment. Automating our time collection. Studies completed at Wilmot indicate that there's a lot of potential here also. If we can get the automated time collection out in the field to control our overtime, that's one of the tools we'll be using to help do that. We'll talk more about that shortly. And finally, Board Member Hines, I think you said last time we didn't talk enough about connecting communities, so I'm focusing on that here. You're welcome. Thank you, actually. Last year, the Silver Line, we were here and we got funding for the initial stage of the preparation of Silver Line. 363 staff, some $20 million to begin preparations. Well, as I mentioned, we'll talk in greater detail about that. The priority corridors, new service has been introduced. It's very successful. We'll continue to roll those out in December and in March. Better bus, Metro Jack's group has now identified 36 lines that do not meet on-time performance standards. And the funding approved by the board last year will be used to enable us to address those deficiencies, increase ridership, improve on-time performance, and enhance customer satisfaction with the system. In FY14, we will continue on that, building on those successes and those initiatives that we planned last year. Silver Line service, Mr. Kubitschek will be going through a very detailed briefing on the service changes, and on the next slide I'll detail some costs associated with those, and then we're also proposing the next phase of our priority bus corridor networks. Again, improving on-time performance, increasing safety, and customer satisfaction.
Mr. Green, Mr. Giancola had a quick question regarding
this. Yeah, on this chart, I actually like this chart as a visual. I would encourage you to not cover the other items, you know. In other words, you just show the 14 ones. But let's go back to the safety culture one. Can I see the first four items? Go back. I wanted to make sure that we had somewhere in safety culture the station lighting issue, and I don't know whether it's quality service or safety, but the lighting issue
may be captured in the capital program. We've got an initiative
over there. Yeah, but still, it's affecting
yes.
this chart, so I would encourage that to be added. And then the other issue is in station cooling. Now you can go to the next iteration. Okay, station cooling, I assume that's safety for keeping a lot of our equipment cooler, thus preventing overheating and things like that, or obviously it's also a quality service issue.
Yes, I'll get into
so
that in a
maybe
moment.
Maybe in multiple areas?
Yes, there's a regulatory, a new regulatory requirement that actually was going to help us increase the maintenance and the repair
okay.
on those facilities.
All right. That's all. I just wanted to add those couple
sure.
things.
Sure. Thank you.
I like the chart, though.
Thanks. I'm glad you said that because Mr. Troop always gives me a hard time about my charts. Next slide, please. Okay, so here's the summary of those initiatives, and this is what we've estimated as the cost. So let me quickly go through them for you. Fatigue management, we put a placeholder in here for some $5.5 million, and I want to emphasize that it is a placeholder. We would envision we would roll out our fatigue management to track and structures and then our rail operations group. You recall last year we got the automated train control and our power group going. Pending the outcome of the fatigue management study, we'll have a much better position to inform you later in the budget process of what the actual need and strategy for addressing fatigue will be. Station cooling, I mentioned that it's a new regulatory mandate, and we'll build on the work that we've been doing over the last few years to increase staffing to perform maintenance and repairs. We're seeking 6 HVAC mechanics. Security camera monitoring, it's more than security camera monitoring, actually. It's a grant requirement, but it was going to increase safety and improve customer security by using real-time information from cameras, fire and intrusion alarms, chemical detection, video analytics, and other tools. And that'll be 24/7 at our operations control center. Customer service training, there's $300,000 in there. This is the first iteration of this will be our bus employees. We're going to roll out a customer service training focusing on caring communication, caring for yourself, caring for difficult customers, and caring for customers with special needs. All of these initiatives, of course, are coordinated with the capital program, and I think if you look in the MEED that was the bias that accompanied this, you'll see where they actually reference which ones have capital investments associated with them. On the Silver Line, as I mentioned, Mr. Kubitschek is going to be presenting a detailed presentation at the Customer Service Committee. This request captures the cost of the refined service plan, including actions to meet the adopted service standards, extend the service to Largo, and to make operational adjustments based on more input and a thorough analysis that the staff has done. It's basically split into two pieces. There's $2 million for propulsion and $2.6 million for staff. There was a question, how does this estimate compare to the estimate that was done in 2007? We researched that, and they're actually remarkably close. The 2007 estimate assumed revenue service would start year-round in FY13. We're now anticipating FY15. The estimate done in FY in 2007 was done on it was a rough order of magnitude estimate, granted, but it was done on a kind of a unit cost basis. They looked at the various functions and determined which unit cost had the most influence on that factor, and then extrapolated the cost out. That estimate was $53.5 million for FY15 to compare apples to apples in year of expenditure dollars. Our new estimate is 54.6 for that same time. So they're very close. On the priority corridor network, the next phase is to improve service on 24 corridors that transport over 50% of our ridership. Those are routes, and I know that there's discussions going on right now in the communities, and there's been discussions with the JCC. We're looking at several routes, 29, the F4, F6, the 80, C2, and the C4, and Rhode Island, Route 1. On the employee wellness, I read a quote here. Healthcare costs have come in $23 million below budget for FY11 and $38 million below projection for FY12. Employees improved their health in 12 of the 14 areas since the inception of the plan. That's from the executive of the King County, where I come from in Seattle. They introduced a program, and those are the types of savings that they generated over a fully mature program with 13,000 employees. So the potential is there, and we're very excited about this program. Healthcare costs and productivity are directly related, are directly tied to the number of claims paid in the year, which they refer to as the trend. Engaging employees in managing their health proactively and incent them to lower the trend is the initiative here. Automated time collection, excuse me. Now this project's going to gradually roll out an integrated time collection system to all hourly, non-exempt, non-operations personnel, excluding the people that are currently captured in our trapeze system. And we expect to see savings here from better time collection, elimination of errors, and reduction of fraud. Slide, please. The FY adjustments, so the total adjustments to the pro forma, you'll recall in the previous slide and where we started this some 4 or 5 months ago, we had about a $76 million gap. We committed to reduce that number, and we've been very successful. We actually lowered that number down to $10 million through a variety of actions and proposed use of budget surpluses and so forth. So the bottom line of this story is very good news is that not only did we reduce it, and we committed to you to try to come back in the range of $25 to $30 million, but we were able to add $17 million in very important initiatives that I just showed you to improve service, improve the customer experience, enhance safety, and connect communities. So with a $27 million now, the estimated increase in the subsidy for next year. This is a display showing the expense budget. This is just you can see the revenues on top, and then you can see the expenses, and you can see where the actual reductions are. You'll notice the revenues, as we go over the passenger fares from 13 to 14, they jump $31 million. Recall that $17 million of that's associated with the Silver Line. Next slide, please. So we're always mindful of those risks. And as we develop this budget, we pay close attention to those risks. We've talked several times about these. Our passenger fare revenues are down about 2% or $5 million in the first quarter, which I'll get to in a moment. We're updating our revenue forecast to reflect our experience through the first 5 months of the year, and we'll actually use that information and to inform our budget proposal that we'll be back to you with in January. Sequestration continues to be a major concern for both our operating and our capital, and we will include the impacts of sequestration, or estimated impacts of sequestration, in our budget transmittal in January as well. Our analysis of rail and ridership revenue through the first 4 months of the year indicate that the reduction of transit benefits is one of the leading contributors to lowering the anticipated rail ridership and revenues. We will know more about our paratransit contract. We've talked to you at the last several meetings about the risk, potential risk there. We'll know about that, more about that contract when we come to you in January. Hopefully, we'll either have awarded the contract or we're very close to awarding that contract. So that will no longer be a risk. It'll be a known. But just to remind you, the new business model, although it's incorporating many of the lessons we've learned over the recent years, there is the major possibility of having contracts with multiple providers. Which could bring additional costs. We'll be bringing the call center and the quality assurance functions in-house, and so those do generate some unknowns and risk. And of course, weather. Reminder that just recently, of course, with Sandy, each day, as I recall, each day that the federal government shuts down costs us $2 million, and I believe it was at the September meeting was recommended that we incorporate that into our revenue forecast, which we have done, a $2 million. A placeholder recognizing the more severity, more frequency, frequent and severe events that have been occurring. And we will also look closely at those closures. Just for your information, Hurricane Sandy, we estimate the revenue loss associated with that event at about $5 million. At the last committee meeting, you asked us to come back to you and give you an update on the staffing and costs associated with the Silver Line. And again, just to repeat, Dave will be giving you a detailed briefing on that later. But we are making excellent progress to bring our staff on board. Our 26 police officers have been hired They're in training at this time, and operations is actually hired 10 of the 190 folks that they had anticipated beginning hiring in January, and they're poised to bring the rest of those on board shortly. Excuse me. We are on track to fill the 363 positions that we approved last year for FY13. This chart also includes 38 positions related to those service changes. I think I didn't mention that at the $4.6 million, there are 38 positions associated with that. And recruitment will be in four phases, as you can see on this chart. So the total number of headcount associated with this program to the beginning of revenue, year-round revenue service, is 461. We were here in February, and that's consistent with those numbers we gave you in February. So moving from headcount to costs, here's an update on the cost. This has been adjusted for the new service changes that will be discussed later, and I've captured all of those costs in the line titled Operations, the third line down. You can see the propulsion. I discussed briefly the components of the service adjustments. So unless there's any other comments, I'll move on there. This is very consistent with the FY 2007 financing plan. Next slide. Thank you. Now I'd like to talk to you a little bit about our first quarter performance. Through the end of quarter one, we had a positive net position of $5.8 million. We had revenue underruns of about $5 million is offset by $11 million in expense underruns. The lower than anticipated ridership and access and delays in executing some other contracts helped offset parts and supplies that were over budget. Total personnel expenses, including overtime, were under budget by $1.3 million. Overtime exceeded budget by $9 million and 62% for the first quarter. Heavy overtime was incurred in July as we had the residual effects of the storm, the derecho, in June. We had heat-related events, and there was a concerted effort undertaken to complete the necessary overhaul and maintenance activities on the 2K and the 5K rail cars. They were all successfully completed. That July effort constitutes 50% of that $9 million. So 50% of the overrun we've incurred was due to our July experience. Overtime management has been identified by the general manager as one of his priorities, and he's formed a team that is chaired by the two deputy general managers, and we've made some excellent progress. And I think when you see your October reports, you'll see that overtime consistently trending down. And we're continuing to put pressure on that in a lot of different areas. Like a lot of financial problems, it's not one thing. There's a series of things, and we're not leaving any stone unturned in that area. Reports and other management tools have been developed to provide supervisors with the ability to track and manage overtime. And I know that those supervisors meet with Mr. Kubitschek on a weekly basis to go over that overtime. And so it's very closely managed and monitored. Expedited and targeted hiring practices combined with training will help reduce overtime by reducing vacancies as we put the right people in the right jobs. And finally, wherever possible, organizations have adjusted staffing plans to assure that they accomplish that work on regularly scheduled. So revenue is down by $5 million as compared to our plan, with a primary driver being lower than planned rail ridership. Next slide, please. So rail ridership, it's down across the board, all dimensions, with the impact of Sandy after this report was delivered, making it worse. The trend appears to be continuing, and we will have some we'll address that, and I'll explain how we're going to do that shortly. Two primary factors associated with the lower than anticipated rail ridership. One was the transit benefit, down from $230 to $125, while the parking was increased to $240. Expansion of the benefit rollover, that is where the employees were allowed to roll that accrual, appeared to have had a delay reaction. That is, they had banked this money, and it took them longer. It took them quite a while to exhaust that banked amount, and so it's just hitting us now. The banked amounts in their accounts, combined with the fare increase, has really put a crimp on the those discretionary trips, those trips that are taken in the off-peak. So our most substantial losses were during the midday and weekend periods, with the July fare increase was proportionally higher in those periods. Combined with the loss of the transit benefit, our riders are taking less discretionary trips. Bus ridership is holding up well, and it's remarkably close to projections. In fact, they were slightly ahead. Even after Sandy was about a $900,000 hit to bus, they were down only about $500,000, if I recall. So bus is doing remarkably and holding remarkably close to our projections. Access ridership is down from our projections by about 10%. As a result of our successful demand management practices, primarily eligibility screening and travel training. The average fare is above budget. The budget was a little bit conservative, we believe, so revenue's on budget. The average fares for bus and rail are tracking very close, within 1% of our projection. We're monitoring the situation very carefully. We are in the process of revising the forecast that we gave to you in October, the financial forecast, the ridership and revenue forecast, and that will inform our budget decision and discussions. As we continue to see this trend, if this trend continues, we are putting in place management actions to control the expenditure side so that we don't find ourselves in a negative financial position. And we'll be meeting over the next coming month to put those actions in place, and we'll be prepared to pull the trigger if this trend continues. There was another question at the last committee meeting, and that was on our unfunded portion of the CNI, what's the breakdown between the state of good repair and the capacity or improvements? And you can see by this chart, it's very demonstrative that our commitment to state of good repair, rebuilding the system in the bottom pie. You can see the funded piece, that's the lower part of the graph in green. That is the funded piece for the period 2011 to 18. Over 94% dedicated towards state of good repair, preservation, those types of activities. The unfunded piece is much split much more evenly between the capacity or customer demand and the state of good repair, with about 44% unfunded need is actually in that latter category. The annual work plan will be released mid-month, and that will also be included in our January budget submittal. And that concludes my presentation. We'll be back to you in January with our budget proposal. If you had any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
We have a number of questions. So we'll start with Mr. Giancola, Mr. Downey, Mr. Nichols, Mr. Dyke. Let's go around the table.
Thank you for the briefing. The previous chart indicated unfunded or capital needs in excess of funding. Under the customer demand, are we dealing with, or is one of the issues the 8-car trains in the system? Is that part of the unfunded part of this, or how? Where does the 8-car trains fit into all this?
We've got an initiative underway to look at the 8-car trains. Planning a study is underway.
But wouldn't that be in this capital needs in excess?
Yeah, the 100% 8-car trains, I'm not entirely sure that the numbers that were presented here, so I can't comment specifically on that, but what I understand is those unfunded needs, that we've identified those costs, and I'm fairly certain that that's included in
okay,
that.
Well,
they are in there.
Just verify that for me at some point.
They are in there. I've just verified it. Thank you.
Mr. Downing?
That's correct.
So if you go out to 2020, there'll be another couple of years at $1 billion plus.
Yes.
It doesn't.
Other question was on fatigue management.
Yes.
$5.5 million. What does that consist of as far as your people to adults for hours?
Yes, as I said, it's a placeholder, so the basis was simply looking at the number of employees that exceeded that 14-hour threshold. The number of employees that, or the shifts, I should say, that were incurred on the seventh day, which is a main contributor to fatigue. And then also we tried to look at some of those shifts and we tried to make some kind of a placeholder, if you will, or a rough estimate of the impact of evening work, and we tried to mitigate some of that. So, right. So, again, once we get more information from the results of the survey, that'll inform our final number.
But when we get to developing a final budget, I hope we don't constrain ourselves to the money we have, but rather look at the need, look at what we have to do, and in my view, is what we have to pay.
Certainly.
Mr. Nichols?
Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation, and actually I had questions on this chart and one related to that. I appreciate your focusing on these initiatives to the extent that these are additive to the gap that we were closing. I think it's important. I'm glad you brought them forward, but I think it would also be helpful if there was an associated metric with, to the extent that these are additive to our costs, there should be an associated metric with what we would expect to achieve as a result of investment beyond dollars that we actually have. And whether if it's fatigue management, there should be a metric associated with what we would gain from that. And we know the value of it. I'm not questioning or challenging that, but I think that there should be an expected metric that associates the benefit with it. Same with customer service training. What is the metric we're trying to improve that that adding this investment would gather, bring to us? Is it fewer complaints? Is it better on time? Or whatever the things are for each of these, I think that's important to, particularly when we're going to add to costs when we're trying to shave them as well. It's not to challenge the value, but I think it's important. The other question, so that really ties to the $76 million and the net of 27 left over. The other question is with respect to the progress made on the hires.
Yes.
Those are all employees that we've brought on board to hit those targets, or have we done, is any of that staffing contract hires or hires through consulting services that would provide the service as we bring forward onboard employees, or are these all hires that would be full-time permanent employees?
These are full-time permanent employees.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation.
My question goes to the federal transit benefit. And I was just curious, do we have a coordinated effort that we're going to be doing to try to change that? For example, I know this evening at NVTC on our legislative agenda, we're talking about making that a big issue with the delegation in Virginia. Is there going to be an effort made by WMATA to sort of coordinate on a regional basis to get our congressional delegations together to do whatever we can to try to address that issue, and is this something that the board can do to be supportive of that?
This has been an ongoing effort by us with regard to the federal government and working on the Hill to achieve it with not just this region, but other transit agencies throughout the United States have been working on this. So far, we have not been successful as an industry to get this changed. We're going to continue that effort, but I am not sitting here saying I'm very hopeful.
Ms. Hines?
Thank you.
Thank you. On the initiatives chart, let me echo Mr. Nichols' comments. It would be really helpful to have a one-page thing that had a little bit more detail than what's in our narrative. As we start to talk with our colleagues in the various places, we have to talk with other funders to sort of be able to show this in more detail and not rely just on our memories, but everybody singing off the same page. I think that would be helpful, and the idea of what would be different at the end is also useful. I want to ask about the math on this page, and so the net increase up there says 15.8, but when I go then to the next page, I'm seeing a $17 million add, and I'm just wondering, what's that other $1.2 million?
It's an error. Good catch.
Okay. Sorry. The people in Arlington hate this, too, because these things, like, they just leap off the page to me. I don't do this on purpose. Returning, Mr. Green, to the issue of rail ridership, if I could, for just a minute.
Yes.
You know, one of the other changes we made when we changed fares was that we went to a distance-based fare all day long from a flat fare once you got out of peak. And no?
Both were distance-based, but they're based on different distances.
Okay, well, I thought during the middle of the day everybody sort of paid one fare. No? No, I know we changed it.
What we did, basically, is we had a distance-based fare for peak.
Right.
And there was a different formula, distance-based for off-peak. They didn't match. What we tried to move towards, and didn't get all the way, is to adopt a policy, basically, that off-peak would be roughly 75% of the peak.
Right.
So there's that change in formulation. So it was not a flat fare versus a distance-based fare. It was.
This is the difficulty of living in an inner jurisdiction. My point, though, is perhaps the same, which is when we're saying discretionary trips are down in the off-peak, I'm wondering if that is, if the shift we made had some impact.
There's no doubt in my mind that once the travel benefit was severely decreased, that things that were fairly inelastic before became more inelastic, because basically you, by taking away that transit benefit in large degree, you made people more sensitive to any fare increases. And, you know, obviously they want to go to work first, and these other discretionary fares had a bigger, it was a bigger impact as a result of that. Now, having said that, we still gained most of the revenue that we thought we gained from doing that. So, yeah, there's a trade-off. It's just there were fewer riders than we anticipated, I think, driven mostly by that change in elasticity.
Ms. Hines?
Mr. Sorrells, that's exactly right. But the other significant impact here is that most of the federal benefit employers who provide it are requiring unused benefit to go back to the federal government, okay? So as a result, that can no longer be banked by a rider, which affects the point that you're making in terms of discretionary trips later on. You have a lot of federal workers that telecommute or that are traveling and may not spend it all in a month. And so that actually has a significant impact, that decision that was made.
When I walked here this morning from the metro, I went by an optometrist, someone who sells eyeglasses. And in their front window were four stands with many, many glasses, and on top of each stand was a letter, F-L-E-X. And underneath of it, it says, you know, you're going to lose it if you don't use it. And I really wonder if there isn't a marketing around this that we ought to be thinking about in order to say to the people who are teleworking or whatever, don't forget, you know, you can do other things with this benefit, you know? Anyway, it just occurred to me.
Okay. Ms. Bowser, then Mr. Downs.
Sorry, sorry, Board Member Hines, I apologize. My staff's informing me I made an error. The $900,000 in the line above, the revenue is captured in the $66 million. So the $17 million is the expense line. I apologize.
Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to ask questions about the new initiatives regarding safety. And I recognize that you have an item in there, I guess it's new, about additional security camera monitoring.
Yes.
My question has to do with any consideration around other public safety initiatives, including our officers. And I'm not sure what type of if we've done an evaluation of our safety officers compared to our service area and our needs. And I'm not sure if that has been done. I guess the point I'm getting to is, do we have enough officers? And I know that we have added the 30 officers for this fiscal year, and I recognize that it doesn't appear to be any enhancement in what you've presented. and I don't know if there should be, but I like to know what kind of analysis we should consider to know if we have the right number of officers.
Last year, as you stated, as we did a multi-year budget, we did increase the number of officers for bus security, and we also increased the number of officers for the other patrols. That was based on our police chief's evaluation of where we are. Remember, we have a very low crime rate on this system. And also, as you will see later in the customer survey, there's a high sense of security by our customers with regard to the system. If you ask any police chief, they'll say they can always use more. Could we do an analysis that compared us to others? We could do that if you'd like, but we haven't at the moment.
Well, I'm also mindful of the fact that we're extending our service area by a significant amount.
And that was taken into account last year when we put together the multi-year budget, and that's reflected in our hiring. In fact, the piece that Bill showed you earlier shows the officers that were already hired or in training to take into account the Silver Line operation.
Similarly, I wanted to ask about our ability, our communications ability, and if that's up to speed or if we need to consider ways to enhance that. For example, when drivers are reporting incidents on buses or trains, and that's communicated to the central station, do we have the ability, and this came up in the discussion, and I'll follow up with you directly about it, Mr. Searles, about the ability of the Metro system to simultaneously broadcast calls to the public safety officials in the local jurisdictions?
As a result of the discussions in the last week or two, we are doing that. We are going to do that. So with regard to bus incidents, I believe, in the areas that were discussed, since Metropolitan Police will be further supporting the effort, I believe the chief, and I was talking to Jack about earlier, are instituting that, so a call will go out to both.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess what I would be interested to know is if the chief has already done some kind of analysis of what the force should be. I'd be interested to see that. And we might consider, a comparative analysis with other jurisdictions. That would help me moving forward.
What you have before you is based on the chief's recommendation. We certainly can do the comparison. I would like to do that with an independent outside effort.
I think that however we get it, I think the data would be helpful.
Okay, so we'll work with the staff too. Could have information. Mr. Downs had a question, and then we can go back to Mr. Cumming.
First, a comment. I greatly appreciate the fact that you're producing a 3-year business plan, 2013, 2014, 2015. I looked at the performance indicators around that business plan, and they look defensible and comprehensive. What I have not seen as part of that so far is the financial performance context for the business plan for 2013, 2014, 2015, a set of estimates about both operating cost, revenues, subsidy expectations over that 3-year period of time. We're all looking for a degree, at least our constituencies are looking for a degree, not of absolute certainty, but some predictability about financial requirements over a multi-year process. Good, I appreciate it. Could I ask a question about Stadium Armory to Largo, and perhaps Mr. Kubitschek will cover it later, but as part of a budget understanding, the cost of the extension from Stadium Armory to Largo is not just the 15 minutes extra running time on the system. The cost that is listed is for both additional staff and propulsion cost. Increase in car requirements for the Silver Line to run to Largo is how many cars?
24.
24 cars. And as I understand, it's going to take some, and they're coming out of the spares fleet?
Yes, we'll be looking to reduce our spare ratio.
And that requires a significant focus on fleet maintenance and dependability during this period of time when we're reducing our
Absolutely.
Spares fleet. Are those car costs, both a depreciation slash operating cost and the intensive maintenance effort that's going to be required, included in the estimated annual operating cost?
The budget that we're going forward with, as it relates, the adjustments that we saw for parts and stuff as part of the budget was something that we've been seeing that's been underrunning for several years. The maintenance that we're looking at as a result of this is really, again, primarily electricity, and it is also with staff. Our expectation during this effort is that some of the intense maintenance that we've done, we've been preparing in advance on some of the major capital efforts that we've been funded through, and we're really looking more along the lines of just traditional maintenance activities.
Just to add to that, a while back, Dave and I had discussions on spare ratios here, and it was our belief that we can improve on the spare ratio. Forget this current discussion. And there has been an effort underway in Dave's shop, not only to prepare for Rush Plus, but to think about the Silver Line and delivery of timing of delivery of 7,000 series cars to step up the maintenance in general, because I felt that when we took care of things here, we should not run as high a spare ratios as we did in the past. And there's been an effort underway to straighten out the parts situation, which I think we got straightened out, to do better preventive maintenance, to do the campaigns on the fleet that have to be done to put this in better shape. So as we approach, this latest wrinkle, and knowing that the 7,000 series cars and getting enough production ones will be later in calendar year 14, what Dave has been doing with his staff, before today, has been working to get all the big campaigns out of the way, so that come the beginning of Silver Line service, projected for a year from now, we can live with a squeezed down spare ratio for a period of time because we'll complete those campaigns. It's a limited period of time. And then we'll get the 7,000 series cars in, the spare ratio will rise back up to where it should be, not back to where it was at one time. And we'll have a good preventive maintenance effort. We'll be able to maintain a decent spare ratio with the cars that we've ordered. So we've been building this into the budget as we looked at spare parts, preventive maintenance. This is not something that, we got to discover now. Dave and his crew have been working on this for some time to get it up. And when I got here, we had 846 cars available for service. Right now, we're up around 900. And he's going to get up around 950 a year from now. Right, guys?
Absolutely. Yes, sir, they say.
Yes.
The reason for the question was not to necessarily challenge the figure, but to establish an accurate operating cost, because one of the things that I think the staff and the board needs to do is look at ultimately the 20-year cost of running full Silver Line service to Largo. We haven't looked at that yet. Whatever we decide to do here, and I agree there is no choice now but to run to Largo initially, what is the cost of establishing a full turnback at Stadium Armory versus the 20-year operating cost, net present value, for that decision without that capital change?
And we'll discuss it more this afternoon. I would just say take a look at the structure out at
I have.
Armory.
I walked it.
And what has to be done to extend the pocket track, to move tracks around, to deal with the structure. And, you know, we can certainly do that estimate analysis, but I would
My guess
surprised.
Is on a net present value basis, the cost to the authority of running full Silver Line train to serve to Largo over a 20-year period is about $200 million. The trade, if you're looking at the cost, is that net present value investment. It may be the right answer, but without looking at both the cost incurred directly in the reconstruction and the operating cost over the next two decades, we're not fully engaging in what the right.
Certainly, we have to look at the cost. I don't know about the $200 million figure, whether it's discounted or not, but we can do that. But what I'm just saying to you, you know, for a long time in this profession, guys like Rob, looking at that structure out there and what has to be done to that, it's huge cost associated with it.
And so is the cost of.
Cost.
Yes, but so is the cost ultimately of running that line full service to Largo. There are operating costs obviously embedded in that forever. We need some way of judging that balance is all.
We can do the analysis.
Okay. I'd like to step in here. We do have a broader discussion of service implications and changes to the Silver Line this afternoon. This is part of an iterative process because I think once we have a more robust discussion about all these issues in terms of the 20-year impact, what are our options, then we'll have to go back and have a thorough discussion about cost implications. And so we may need to come back in January, for instance, and go back to these questions that we've been raising. So in the interest of time, I don't want to necessarily jam Mr. Downey's committee either. In terms of time, I'd like to, if there are other questions regarding the budget proposal that you see here, just move forward. And Mr. Baldwin was next, actually, so I'd like to let him.
Well, I just wanted to follow on, and as I read in the paper, which is the last place I would like to read about it, that the Orange Rush Plus is going to be curtailed because we're going to go to Largo with the Silver Line. So where's the net savings of eliminating Orange Rush Plus to Largo? Is that in the numbers we're getting today?
The discussion that we'll be having this afternoon at 1 o'clock is going to address that.
All right.
Also, the number that was posted in the newspaper at the 4.6, there are really three components of that. While everything is focused at the D&G junction in 4.6, that's not actual. I mean, we can break it down, and that's what I intend to do. I can tell you right now, there's a heads up of D&G naturally. There's a heads up for the service standards criteria. There's also a heads up of what we're going through and what we found out at Wheelie Avenue. Okay? And those are the three segments that are embedded into this. So whenever we do talk about the D&G and the life cycle function of it, the maintenance and everything else, and doing the overall analysis for operating that, as Mr. Sarles has said, this has started a long time ago, and for example, on the 7000 series, like when we look with parts and stuff, we started that in 2007. That car has eliminated an overhaul cycle based off of the newer technology than what we're facing today. So there are some analysis behind the scenes that have been taking place for many years.
Okay. Is this related to the service Silver Line again?
Yes,
okay.
It is.
Let me just add one comment,
okay, please?
Okay, just add a comment, then we'll move
Okay,
on.
Thank you. And I appreciate the importance of this discussion. I really want to reinforce what you were saying a moment ago, but I'd like to just add, and I appreciate the comments, Tom's comments, in the context of the cost overall, but I think it's important that we have this discussion in context, appropriately in context. I mean, we've asked for some additional analysis. I think that's certainly appropriate, but to, you know, project a $200 million cost, Tom, when we don't really have a context for that number in the context of any other aspect, I think is an inappropriate numerical discussion right now. And I'd like to have the discussion in a full context that doesn't create information that's not well-founded, not well thought out based on your experiential context, but just in terms of this discussion, let's do it with full information as appropriate.
That was my point.
Okay.
I know. But I don't know that $200 million is a number that's relevant to the discussion or not. Might be, but let's do it in a context. That's all I'm asking.
But the point is really, is there long-term implications to running this service all the way through? So, right, I understand. So we're trying to get a better handle on that. I think we all owe ourselves the service. We're doing ourselves a disservice without, we need to hear the entire service plan and then have a discussion about all the consequences, and then that includes a discussion about budget. So I think we do owe it to ourselves to hear out full discussion, this full service plan at this afternoon's discussion. Then I do think these issues will come into play, and I think we can get a better sense of what both the short-term and long-term consequences are to our budget, as well as the service to our customers. Any other questions outside of this regarding the presentation that Mr. Green made? Okay. If not, thank you, Mr. Green. And are there any other matters to come before this committee? Okay. All right. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.